A novel of the old Wild West opens us to contemporary lessons about the human capacity for love and hatred.
If you strip us back, and think of us in terms of the absolute essential nature of the human person, like the essential nature of the buffalo, the essential nature of the robin, what is it? What is it that redeems us, in a way, in this seemingly blank face of creation? And the only thing I can suggest after 61 years of life and having written for 40 years is this extraordinary, unexpected capacity we have as a creature to put ourselves in another person's place and to moderate our language because we have understood what that language will do when it arrives in that other person's brain. That's to say, to feel like the other person, and therefore, which creates the mercy of human beings, which creates the tolerance of human beings, and also goes beyond tolerance to just that instinct in human beings that sometimes takes your breath away and catches you unawares of actually showing such grace that you think, oh, well, after all, even though I have a rather bleak, dark view of humanity, actually, there's also this. This light piercing down through the cloud.
That's Sebastian Barry. We talk with him about his heartbreaking and redemptive novel, Days Without End. It won the prestigious Costa Book of the Year Prize in January. Then, a debut novel uses magical realism to explore what is revealed and what remains hidden.
I was really interested in thinking about how magical or otherwise, our own private realities do change the way we deal with the world, and that even the people closest to us may not know what's going on underneath the surface in our private reality that may at the same time be affecting everything we do, even if it's something that the outside world really can't decipher.
That's Adelia Saunders. We talk with her about her novel, Indelible. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The classic tropes of the cowboy western feature John Wayne-type He-Man who conquer the Indian savages and sweep pretty women off their feet. It's the classic formation myth of the American identity in all its racist and macho glory. But my guest, Irish writer Sebastian Barry, paints a different portrait of the Old West in his acclaimed new novel, Days Without End. His story is told by a poor Irish immigrant, Thomas McNulty, who escapes famine in his own land to become a soldier in ours, first in the Indian Wars and then the Civil War. McNulty's companion throughout is his lover and brother-in-arms, John Cole. The two of them, both orphans, participate in the brutal slaughter of Indian families, and then take in a remarkable young girl, orphaned by their own actions to make a redemptive family of their own. Barry's treatment of the relationship between Thomas and John is both matter-of-fact and infinitely tender, and was in part informed by the coming out of his own son as a gay man. Days Without End tells a story of terrible violence and inhumanity, yet also one that is profoundly human in its exploration of the healing power of love. Barry's exuberant and poetic voice brings a powerful contemporary resonance to this story about immigrants, identity, injustice, and compassion. Sebastian Barry is an Irish playwright, novelist, and poet. He's considered one of Ireland's finest writers. He's twice been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize for his novels A Long, Long Way and The Secret Scripture, the latter of which won the 2008 Costa Book of the Year, as has Days Without End this year. This wonderful book, Days Without End, you are an Irish writer. This book is almost a kind of quintessentially American novel. And yet there is a continuity. Your protagonist, Thomas McNulty, is Irish. You've written about the McNulty family before in your previous books. So tell us, why did you turn your attention to the American frontier here?
Well, the there's a curious sense in which an Irish person who stayed in Ireland, who has never been to America, is still, in some senses, a strange, dislocated American, because a lot of our imaginative space is filled with American films as children, American books, in later years, all the great American novels and all the incredible poets of America. So that when you go to America for the first time, as I did when I was 17 and hitched around 4,000 or 5,000 miles of Tennessee and all those places, it's as if you've already been there, because you recognize the scenery, you recognize the accents, you recognize the language. I remember the shock, indeed, in 1984 when I went to Iowa City to the university there, of being in a cinema and realizing that the people sitting around me were watching a story about their own immediate culture. Do you know, if you can understand that. So it's not a place imaginatively that's too far away to go to. It doesn't feel like a long distance. The other enthralling thing, I think, in a way, about something like the 1850s, 60s in America is that, in a way, all those places don't exist anyway anymore. That, you know, Americans have to go there in their imaginations to reach them, because the roads don't go there anymore. You know, everything has so utterly changed. I wanted to follow an Irishman who possibly I share a little bit of DNA with there, because I wanted to try and understand that paradox of a native person like Thomas being driven out of his home country, maybe after a few hundred years of colonization of his people, native people, as it were, of Ireland, and then engaging for survival in the decimation and destruction of another native peoples. And what did that mean, and what does that say about the human person? And is it just an evil, or, you know, are there 7,000 different faces to that? And so that's what I was after in the book, and that's why I went there.
Yeah, it does seem this book deals so much with the issues of identity, the creation of identity on the one hand, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a second, but also on the underlying humanity that goes right across borders and separations.
Yeah, because when you take everything away from us, I mean, as a creature, I mean, supposing all our religious beliefs are based on nothing, and they are also fictions. And if you strip us back, you know, and think of us in terms of the absolute essential nature of the human person, like the essential nature of the buffalo, the essential nature of the robin, what is it? What is it that redeems us in a way in this seemingly blank face of creation? And the only thing I can suggest after 61 years of life and having written for 40 years is this extraordinary, unexpected capacity we have as a creature to put ourselves in another person's place and to moderate our language, because we have understood what that language will do when it arrives in that other person's brain. That's to say, to feel like the other person, and therefore, which creates the mercy of human beings, which creates the tolerance of human beings, and also goes beyond tolerance to just that instinct in human beings that sometimes takes your breath away and takes you and catches you unawares of actually showing such grace that you think, oh, well, after all, even though I have a rather bleak, dark view of humanity, actually, there's also this light piercing down through the cloud.
And it is that common humanity that creates the joy that comes through so much in this book, but also a developing sense of self-identity. I mean, there's terrible violence in the book, but this protagonist, Thomas McNulty, is a gay man in the early to late to mid 19th century in America, and takes a great deal of joy in his experience and the gender fluidity that he experiences. Talk a little bit about that and how you developed that character and his relationship with his lover, John Cole.
Well, if you take the larger picture of gayness, obviously it is part of our glory as a human creature that some of us have always been gay. I mean, there's 7 to 10%, I'm sure, of Australopithecus who are gay, and it's part of who we are. And, you know, and the evil is when people say otherwise, you might say. But, I mean, that's the larger thing, and it's actually very liberating and exciting for a novel, especially a stupid straight novelist like me, to enter on a new subject like that and try and read the history and see how seldom it's remarked upon in the books, gay relationships. Of course, and we're not even using the right language because these words didn't exist in the 1850s. We don't even know the actual dialect of gayness of the time. But because there's a certain amount of discretion involved in the whole thing. But obviously, infinitely obvious in a way, that such lives were led, and heroically led when you think of the obstacles. But apart from that macro way of looking at it, on the more familial, closer level, I mean, my own son, Toby, who is a very beautiful person and a very gifted musician and a magnificent soul in every respect, was very unhappy a few years ago when he was only 16. And I didn't know why he was unhappy, and I was terribly worried about him, as you do when young men are unhappy, because that's a very, very dangerous thing. And sometimes the cause can be tiny, sometimes it can be big. You just don't know. Anyway, eventually Toby came in one morning to me and Ali and said, the thing is, Dad, I'm gay. And I was so relieved to hear him say possibly the cause of his disquiet and confusion that my immediate instinct was celebration, you know, and to thank him for saying it and, you know, congratulate him. And in the ensuing couple of years that happened to coincide with the starting of the book, he more or less instructed me rather than a father instructing a son. And the son instructs the father about what gayness is and how it manifests itself and what it entails. And I was able to observe, had the privilege of observing the, you know, the love between him and his first boyfriend, Jack. And I just looked at it very closely as I could. And I came to the conclusion, you know, quite quickly that this isn't something to be tolerated as such, you know, which we're always being asked to do, and quite rightly, but also celebrated. Here's a part of human life that is, in some quarters, traditionally derided, and bad forces are brought against this state of being. But here it is, an absolute object lesson in how to love. So this is something, you know, straight people could really learn from. And there's aspects of it, I thought, that just weren't available to straight people, that these were quintessentially important aspects of human love that only a gay person can manifest. And these were like huge harvests of both poetry and wonder for the observer. So anyway, as you can imagine, since I happened to be writing the book at that time, the book just drew all these things into itself, like a Death Star absorbing other planets. And it became so much part of the book. And it's become so much part of the adventure of the book. And my son said to me the other day, he said a lovely thing, you know, which is the best, really, compliment I could expect. He said, "You're not gay, Dad," he said, "but you're an ally." And I thought, well, that's wonderful. And in a way, this is a novel written by an ally and admirer and wonderer at the state of gayness. And I think that the two men in the book love each other in a way I have been privileged to observe my son being in love with somebody. And what can I say? I feel like I'm a slightly better person for having been given this complicated gift.
That's so beautiful. What are some of the ways that you discovered the uniqueness or the unique gifts of the gay relationship?
I remember when I was his age, you know, every 16-year-old is an experimenter of life. You know, you're the nascent scientist of life. Everything is new. You don't realize that other people have solved these equations or messed them up before you. So it's like you have to create the mathematics of life all for yourself, and that's what they're doing. And they often don't consult their parents in this, and they consult their friends who are equally beginning. What I noticed in particular was that, unlike the tempestuous, disastrous, my memories of trying to be in love with somebody, which were all so complicated between the opposite sex, just seemed to be designed for disaster and trouble and God knows what. These two young men, I was very impressed by how gentle they were with each other and how very precise and always immediately, in a way that I don't think I could ever have done, thinking their way into how the other was feeling. And as I was talking about earlier, you know, like the novelist trying to sit in the other person's head and gauge what they were going to say by how it would be received in that imagined space. And I was very, very impressed by that. And I thought that's something, you know, we all could learn from. What I'm saying is the kind of ultra humanity of that gay imagination.
It puts me in mind of Lincoln's love letters to his male companion. I mean, almost because certainly in a society where men and women were even more divided, I guess one could argue, than today, although I think that there's, you know, still the battle of the sexes does rage on, you know, the companionship that was the friendship that was permitted between same-sex people is what allows the kind of relationship you speak about in this beautiful novel, Days Without End, Sebastian Barry.
And you know, later in the century, Walt Whitman is the laureate of that love. And when his poetry came to England, where I just accidentally happened to be at the moment, it was such a huge solace to gay people of that period in England. Here was a man who understood the important things and was writing about them. And indeed, you know, when I wrote a play about Hans Christian Andersen, who was gay himself, and he had this incredible relationship with quite a much younger actor in Denmark when Andersen was quite old. And what a huge, not just solace to him it was, you know, in his journals and his letters, but a sort of a reward to him for being alive, you know, that sort of feeling. And as you say, these incredible exchanges, epistolary exchanges, you might say, between men of the period, not only in England, but in America. And, you know, the other curious thing about history is that just because something isn't written about constantly or obviously, it certainly doesn't mean it's not there. So in a way, it's a kind of great thrill and excitement for a novelist of any description to try and go in and identify what was happening in those silences and those things not spoken of and those things not mentioned and what was contained there. And furthermore, it was enormous solace to me as a creature to see that they're, having brought up three kids, that their whole impulse as human beings, Thomas and John Cole, is towards the protection of Winona, who is the young Lakota Sioux girl that they take into their care, more or less. And just the way they are tending towards this incredibly dynamic and important family unit in the America of the time, simply because the America of the time was so infinitely dangerous. They're dangerous on every side all the time. And these two men take it upon themselves out of sheer love, a love that they've learned with each other, one loving the other, have acquired a quality of love which they are able then to utilize for their absolute protection of this girl. And I mean, I was surprised writing the book. I didn't plan any of those things. And it just made me feel, you know, a little bit rewarded myself to come across those things in the things that Thomas had to tell me in his narrative.
And one other influence, it seemed to me, in that love for their adopted daughter was guilt. A certain way into that, because they,
really,
of course, are the, you know, were participating in the massacre that killed her parents.
And, you know, Thomas understands that as an objective correlative in Keatsian terms, because he himself, as a boy, has seen his entire family die of starvation on the floor of their house in Ireland, in Sligo, and has been obliged by history and fate to steal his way onto a coffin ship and try and get away, and try and get away firstly to Canada. He understands in his bones and in his blood that sort of dispossession, even though he might never articulate that for us or even realize it himself. But he understands Winona as his true daughter, because she has had all her people taken away from her in the most awful slaughter. And yes, it's not only guilt, but maybe more importantly, reparation fostered by guilt, that out of the ruins, out of the chaos of a nascent country, and out of destruction of people who were in full possession of that country, if one is being honest, and it had to be wrested from their grasp, he's able to make or require or wants to make a kind of provisional accounting between himself and whatever gods he thinks are around the place, and save this person, this girl. But of course, the irony then is that she is so magnificent herself that she is in the process of saving them, because she confers upon them all the blessing and potency and power of family.
Exactly. But talk also of the other side of this book, the terrible violence. You know, in the massacre that that John and Thomas wreak upon her family, there's the both the bloodlust as well as the hint of contradiction. I mean, he asks himself, what is this weight of sorrow, as he's, you know, going right into battle there. Talk about these two, the light and the dark of this situation.
Well, as I sat there for my year of reading for the book, you know, all the reading you do, and then, of course, it has to be all forgotten in a way because it has to rise up naturally. But there were often times when I just sat there so affrighted myself, so shocked and pained by what I was reading that I just thought I couldn't do this. Similar to when I was writing a novel about the First World War, the Irish soldiers, I'd read about the battles and I just think, no, I can't do it. And then you think, well, you have to do it because, you know, this is part of human experience. And if you don't go in your perfect safety as a middle-class Irish writer in 2016, if you won't go back and do it, then, you know, you fail somehow in your duty. So you go back and, you know, it's not, as I say, it's of no mortal danger to me to do it. But nevertheless, the depths, I mean, frankly, the depths of cruelty against these people that people of the time were so content to call savages. I mean, even it is so abysmal. I mean, even the great Francis Parkman, who at the time was considered to be the first great American historian, in his wonderful book, The Oregon Trail, there's also published, as well as that book, which is about him going west to try and find Indians who hadn't been touched by Europeans. There's a whole volume, there's a whole load of journals and notes that he made at the time of doing the journey when he was 19. And in that, in the journals and notes, he's quite uncomplimentary about native peoples, I have to say, and he doesn't have a very high opinion of them. And 20 years later, when he's writing the book, when all those scenes have disappeared, of course, so quickly did it disappear, you know, he has lost that kind of pejorative tone, both against Native Americans, indeed, about, and also about Europeans on the ferries, which he doesn't seem to think very highly of either. But, you know, there's a changing, there's always a ringing change, even at the time, you know, attitudes are shifting. Parkman is a very interesting writer. I think he chose the wrong themes for his great opus of history, an obscure French-Canadian wars. But I heartily recommend him to read him, especially The Oregon Trail, which is a great book.
And it seems to me also that this book so much touches on the completely current issues that are facing us today. I mean, not just immigration, not just gender equality, not just LGBTQ rights, you know, but also the rights of Native Americans. I mean, very much confronting this manifest destiny of this country, you know, this kind of colonial project that involves so much brutality and out of which, you know, I almost feel as if we now are experiencing the fullness of the karma of what we have done in the past, whether it be slavery or, you know, the subjugation of Native Americans. And this book has to be read within that, with those two time periods in mind.
Well, I mean, if I may say, that's beautifully observed, Francesca. But there was nothing I was reading about. This is the strange thing. I mean, truly strange thing. I mean, almost eerie thing was that there was a very few things I was reading about happening in the 1850s that didn't seem to be being echoed on the current, you know, the television and the radio. This whole talking about, there's enough, you know, in the 1850s they were talking about there's enough people in America. We need to close the borders now. We have enough people. There's no room. We're absolutely full of inhabitants. That's it. That'll do us, you know. And interestingly, about Manifest Destiny, which of course breaks your heart when you use the very phrase. But you know, encouragingly, in the time, there were plenty of voices raised in disgust at the idea of Manifest Destiny. Largely, you know, a lot of people in the East. And in Washington, indeed, were totally against these notions. But what happened on the knife edge of it, where the army was being sent to, you know, deal with things, what was really distressing was the initial accommodation that they tried to make between Native peoples and themselves and then the various treaties. But usually the last order you hear in all these accounts and all the fates of the incredible people that were living there in America is this terrible order, kill them all, which you keep seeing restated in the histories. I mean, the crazy thing about it is once you start to say savages, this is exactly what was said about the Irish, you know, in Elizabethan times, or in Cromwellian times too. You know, we were savages, we were lice, we weren't really human, we were the missing link between apes and man, we were to be erased, and very nice English people were to be put in, and then it would be made a paradise in Ireland, et cetera, et cetera. All these statements about peoples that are made legitimize this process of erasure and murder. And, of course, the incredible thing about Native America, if I may speak to it, is, because I think, you know, there's a responsibility also not to speak in a strange sort of way, is that, you know, if they weren't there 14,000 years, they were there 40,000 years. So I think they knew how to live in America, and I think they knew how to inhabit their own land. And I think, you know, we have to accept that 90% of Native peoples disappeared after the touchdown of whatever, of Europeans from various viruses. So that far, far in the interior, hundreds of years before any white person ever got there, peoples were dying of these viruses that had spread at their own speed. Mm-hmm. You know that there was an intimate and infinite destruction of a people to whom this place utterly belonged. And in a way, my conclusion, while I concluded that being gay was a magnificent thing, my conclusion after reading it for a year in American history was that if you don't start there with American history, if you don't start there honestly in schools with this bare fact that America was founded upon an erasure, a murder of a people, then you can't really go on legitimately to talk about the glories of America, which are legion in themselves also. You know, once this new people began, we have all the poetry that I mentioned, we have all the novels, we have all the films, we have all the music, we have all the sheer lives, we have all the passions, we have all the private histories, we have all these things that took place then in those same spaces. But I think you have to acknowledge that, you know, something truly, truly terrible was prosecuted and befell these people. I mean, my thinking about that did begin with a very short friendship that I had with the wonderful Peter Matheson, who wrote very much, you know, wrote The Spirit of Crazy Horse, which was about Pine Ridge in the 1970s, and later, a little later in 75, Leonard Peltier, who we all were very sad that he wasn't released by Obama recently. You know, he's been in prison for 20 years. And Peter talking to me about those things really, I think, colonized that part of my brain that thinks about these things. I think about them in sorrow and with also an enormous measure of wonder at the sort of dangerous, redeemed creature that we are.
Yes, and I wish we could talk more. I know you have to go to another appointment, but on those beautiful words, which very much informed the topics that you just, you know, what you just touched on, and your book, which really shows that it is in recognizing, you know, I think that story of reparation, that's just what you've spoken of. I mean, that you talk about, what you show in the family in your wonderful novel, Days Without End, is really what we need to do throughout. Thank you for talking with me. It's a wonderful book, and it was such a privilege to read.
Thank you.
Sebastian Barry. Let's listen to him read a short excerpt from his new novel, Days Without End.
The method of laying out a corpse in Missouri sure took the proverbial cake. Like decking out our poor lost troopers for marriage rather than death. All their uniforms brushed down with lamp oil into a state never seen when they were alive. Their faces clean shaved, as if the embalmer sure didn't like no whiskers showing. No one that knew him could have recognized Trooper Watchorn because those famous Dundrearys was gone. Anyway, death likes to make a stranger of your face. True enough, their boxes weren't but cheap wood, but that was not the point. You lift one of those boxes and the body makes a big sag in it. Wood cut so thin at the mill it was more a wafer than a plank, but dead boys don't mind things like that. The point was, we were glad to see them so well turned out, considering.
And that was Sebastian Barry reading from his novel Days Without End. His other novels include A Long, Long Way and The Secret Scripture. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Days Without End. Next up, we talk with Adelia Saunders about her debut novel, Indelible. Stay tuned after the break.
I be your mirror, reflect what you are. In case you don't know, I be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door, to show that you're home. When you think the night has in your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Please put down your hands, 'cause I see.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What if you could read the truth about a person written on their skin? Would it be a gift or a curse? Would you tell them what you see, or would you keep it secret? That's the idea that lies at the center of Adelia Saunders' terrific debut novel, Indelible. It traces three intersecting stories. First, there's Magdalena, a young woman from Eastern Europe who can read the details of a person's life on their skin. She meets Neil, a young American scholar studying in the Paris archives, who carries Magdalena's name on his cheek, something only she can read. And unbeknownst to them, Neil's father is also consulting the archives in Paris on the trail to uncover the truth about the mother who abandoned him. Adelia Saunders tells her story with deft precision to her plot and exploration of character. Indelible is a real page-turner with a totally satisfying ending. Adelia Saunders, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is really a terrific book, a fascinating book of really three intertwining stories that is so beautifully constructed, how they all come together. It's a story of three protagonists, and let's start with the first one, your main protagonist, that's Magdalena. Tell us about her and the incredible gift that she was born with.
So Magdalena is Lithuanian, and it so happens that she was born with either a gift or a curse. She just happens to see writing on people's skin. And these words that she sees are facts about people's lives. They're all that would be included in a person's record. So they include some facts that are very sort of banal and ordinary, where they were born and where they went to school and who they married and how they died. And sometimes they can be really tragic, or sometimes they can be really uninteresting, or sometimes they can hint at deeper and more poetic things. But poor Magdalena has to see them. They are just on the skin of every person that she meets. And this complicates really every facet of her life. And she's fortunate in that she's also terribly nearsighted. So one of the ways that she copes with this ability is just by taking off her glasses. And when the story begins, that's sort of where she's at. She's kind of wandering through life in a fog.
So where did this fantastical notion come to you?
I got very interested in archives, and I happened to be working with my husband on a project that took us to the National Archives in Lithuania, and we spent a lot of time going through old documents, and it was so interesting to me what would be included in a personnel file. Really, all that was left of a person's life, the documentation of a life 50 or 100 years after that person was gone, and you would see just these little scraps of details about their life, like a little bit about where they went to school, who they married, some sort of indecipherable document hinting at some much larger story. Suddenly you turn the page and there's an arrest record. And then we would sometimes find really intensely personal little scraps in these files. You'd find maybe a caption on the back of a photograph that hinted at some larger story. And I was interested in the idea of how a person would deal with knowing from the beginning all that is going to happen to the people that she meets, the people that she loves, her friends, and really how awful in many ways that would be.
Right. Now, what were you doing in Lithuania in the archives?
It's kind of a long story, but the two parts of the story, my husband and I were living in Paris for a year. I was getting set to go to graduate school, and I was doing some coursework in Paris. And I had, as a high school student, lived actually in Latvia, next door to Lithuania, as a high school exchange student. So while we were in Paris, we thought we would take a trip to visit my host family and also to go to Lithuania, where my husband's family was from. My husband's family, his mother, who was a small child, and his grandmother were the only members of their family to survive the Holocaust. And like I think probably any Holocaust survivors, they had a tremendous story of how that miracle happened. And there actually was a book, a novel written about my husband's grandmother's survival story. It came out in the 1970s in the United States. And my husband was very interested in sort of learning the story of this story and how much of what was in this novel, which he had always been told was 100% his grandmother's true story, could really be substantiated by the records. So that's how we got into the archives in Lithuania and really started a fascinating search through these old documents that got me very interested in the idea of files.
And were they substantiated?
Yeah, many of the details were. There were interesting gaps, too, and I think in some ways the gaps were very interesting, maybe as interesting as the facts that we were able to substantiate. But we would find, for example, my mother-in-law, who was a young child at the time and was really one of the only children to survive the Vilna ghetto, we found these records of her with her name. She was maybe two or three listed in the ghetto files, which were these handwritten census forms done in this like kind of purplish bluish ink, showing how many families had been put into single apartment and what addresses they lived. So we could actually find exactly where she and her mother and the rest of their family at that point had been living inside the Vilna ghetto. And we also found records of my husband's family, people who didn't survive, people we hadn't even known existed. And it was really eerie. I mean, it was strange for me, and this wasn't my story, to see my mother-in-law's name, my mother-in-law, who I know is this sort of like New York kind of bohemian artist woman, as a tiny child in the ghetto in Lithuania, I mean, it was strange. And just the way that, like, you would see these, the handwriting, you knew that somebody had stood in holding that piece of paper with her right in front of them and written her name down. It was a kind of a strange collision of history, one of those times when you feel like you've sort of fallen through a trap door and you're suddenly back in time.
So what is, just curious before we go on to the your own novel, your wonderful novel, Indelible, what was the name of that novel?
Yeah, it was called Anya, and it was written by Susan Fromberg Schaefer. I think it came out in 1974.
Wow, that's fascinating. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Adelia Saunders about her new novel, Indelible. Now, in Indelible, this whole notion of a person's life written on their skin is a kind of magical realism that also has a very powerful kind of salience, you know, a kind of metaphor. Is it a metaphor or is it just magical realism?
Well, I like the idea of having a story that takes place in the real world, in our reality, where there's a single element of magical realism, something fantastical dropped in, and then to see how this affects everything. And so you mentioned that there are sort of three intertwining stories in this book. Two of the three characters have no idea about this ability and wouldn't believe in it if you told them. And yet, the fact that the third character is living in a reality where really everything is sort of warped by the fact that she has this ability affects their lives too. And so I was really interested, I guess, in thinking about how magical or otherwise our own private realities do change the way we deal with the world, and that even the people closest to us may not know what's going on underneath the surface in our private reality that may at the same time be affecting everything we do, even if it's something that the outside world really can't decipher.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. In a way, everybody is exposed to her, which she can't really share with them. On the other hand, even if she did have writing on her own skin, it wouldn't be exposed to them because they weren't able to see it. But she does not have writing on her skin. Why is that?
Well, she doesn't know, and that's been a central fact of her life, too. I mean, the fact that she reads the facts of people's lives, their past and their future, unavoidably off of every person that she meets, and yet her own skin is blank, and she doesn't know what that means. Does that mean that she's sort of not really there, that she isn't really meant to be there? And I think when the story starts, that is kind of what she thinks. She thinks that she is some awful mistake. And the story is, in a small way, I mean, in a sort of quiet way, her story is about her figuring out what it means to be unmarked herself.
And in a way, you're also saying that we are all also unknowable to ourselves.
Well, yeah, we should all be so lucky not to know where we're going or be constantly reminded of where we've been.
Now, let's talk about the other two protagonists. There is Neil, a young man who, the first time she meets him, she's startled to find her own name is written above his cheekbone. Who is he?
Well, Neil's a college kid, and he's from sort of a crummy little town in Colorado, and he's studying abroad in London when we first meet him. And Neil is a sort of, I mean, he's like 20 years old, but he's a scholar. He's studying history, and he just absolutely loves it. And he's so excited to become a part of this bigger world of the great stories of the past. He's also a bit of an awkward guy who can never quite talk to girls.
And his father is the other protagonist. He's in Paris as well. Of course, we said that these are intertwining stories. He's got a very interesting pursuit of research in the archives of his own.
Right. Neil's father's name is Richard, and he happens to be the son of a famous American novelist. His mother was well known for being brilliant and for losing her mind and for dying young under tragic circumstances. She also abandoned her only child essentially at birth. And so Richard was raised on a farm in Colorado by his aunt and uncle. and all his life has clung to the unshakable belief that his mother came back once to see him, and he has this memory of seeing her shoes, and he knows this is true, and every bit of evidence, everyone that knows anything about his mother's life knows that she didn't come back to see him. She left her kid, and she never, ever paid him a second thought. And so Richard has come to Paris because he thinks he'll find evidence in Paris that his mother really did come back to the farm in Colorado to see him once when he was a young boy.
And he's also, you know, it's a kind of a curious position to be in, something that he remembers, but he was so young, everybody insists that he's wrong. Is this a little bit about, I mean, you're doing your work in, you did your work in archives. It was an inspiration to the story. Archives are like the original sources. Is this something a little bit about the difference between original sources and their interpretation by the establishment?
Well, yeah, I think it's about memory and truth and how completely different those two things are and how slippery and multifaceted truth is. There are so many things that we believe we know, and there are so few ways to ever know for sure. And I think it's very interesting when you have somebody, when faith comes up against facts, and I mean when somebody believes in something despite facts to the contrary. And also, I think with the Richard character, he has sort of built a life around a memory that, of course, everybody tells him couldn't possibly be true. And I see a kind of, I think this happens all the time, but I do see a kind of a heroism in that, his unshakable belief that the thing that he needs to believe in order to really function, to exist, to be at peace with this history of abandonment as a child, he makes sure he does believe in it, despite everything.
Now, Richard is the only one of your protagonists who's written in the first person. Why is that?
Well, Richard's story, he's consciously telling his story. And I thought that was important for him because Richard is, in some ways, really kind of an unreliable narrator. He's presenting the facts as he wants them to be and as he sees them. And it was also important to me that we go through Richard's sort of discoveries with him. When he starts talking about it, he doesn't know what he's going to find. And so we sort of discover them with him. I hope this, in some small part, is kind of an adventure story in the archives. And that may not sound like the most gripping setting for an adventure story, but I truly believe it is. I think there's something so exciting about discovery in dusty documents. And so I wanted Richard's story to kind of pull the reader along with him. And I also needed there to be distortion in the facts that the reader got because they're coming through Richard's own first-person perspective.
Yes, I share with you that excitement. I spent about 10 years in dusty archives exploring my own father's World War II story, and ended up discovering when the process was all done, I knew more than all the actual participants in the story because I had been able to connect so many different things and find out so many different pieces. And there was a certain serendipity. There was a certain sense that something was guiding me. I don't know if you felt that when you were doing your own actual research in the archives, but things would come up that would answer questions that I had had and just suddenly appear when I needed them.
Oh, absolutely. I always feel like they're little, often benevolent sort of spirits fluttering around, turning that page over for you that you just absolutely need to see. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think that the documents we leave behind, they do often tell stories that people didn't even know were happening at the time, and I find that really fascinating.
Now, this is your first book. Tell us a little bit about your process in approaching, you know, this whole new endeavor, you know, writing a piece of fiction for the first time. What were the greatest challenges that you faced?
Well, God, I mean, I ended up working on this project over really an embarrassingly long amount of time. I think I started when I was 25, and I'm 32. So there you go. I started working on this project when my husband and I were living in Paris for this sort of wonderful year of our lives. And then I went back to graduate school and I was studying international relations. And then my daughter was born, and then we had a second child. And so this book really sort of got written in like bits and snatches of time here and there, and much of it during baby's nap times, which I actually think was probably a good thing, because when you have limits on your time, you end up using it fairly well. I mean, you really try to get the most out of it, and it definitely gave me a kind of a discipline for working on the project. But the challenge of working on something over such a long period of time is, I don't know if it's a challenge exactly, but you learn so much through this process. At least I felt like I did, that there were times, especially during the sort of revision process, when I thought, oh, if I could just start this whole thing again, I could put to use all that I've learned in the process. But that was a really wonderful thing too. I mean, I have, because there was so much else going on in my life during the time I was working on this project was always sort of like my secret place that I could go that was mine, and has made me so happy over this time. You know, I'm a little sad to be done with it.
Had you started out, did you think that you were or always had a dream of being a novelist?
Well, I really like to read. So, yeah, I think probably, I don't know that I would have said it necessarily, but yeah, I've always wanted to write too. And I think when you're really a reader, I mean, that to me is like to make a book of my own is such an exciting idea. But no, it wasn't really my stated goal to write a novel.
So, you know, a long time ago, we interviewed Francine Prose about her wonderful book, Reading Like a Writer, in which she talks about the writers who have taught her how to write. So who are your influences?
Wow. I found it helpful when I was working on this project to, I read a lot of biographies, and I found that I liked reading things that were not similar at all to what I was working on. I read several Zola, Emile Zola novels while I was working on this, which I think helped sort of ground me as somebody who might tend toward kind of juicy descriptions of things. When you read a Zola novel, it is story and character and plot, and it's just so crisp and practical. And I really enjoy, and I think probably benefited from reading things like that. And like I mentioned, reading biographies, I love getting that kind of when you read a biography of a person. I read a fantastic biography of Isaac Dinesen by Judith Thurman, where you get this rich life of a very interesting person told in a way that adds almost, well, what a good novel does too, adds a richness to and a context to that person's life. I think reading things like that taught me how, or help me kind of try to figure out how to tell a story that moves, a story that really goes from event to event to event, mm-hmm. and not getting bogged down in atmosphere, which I think sometimes novelists can do.
And was it a challenge to find, this got published by Bloomsbury mm-hmm. Press, which is one of the major presses. Was it a challenge in, you know, finding an agent or getting your work read?
I didn't really know how to go about it. It actually ended up being quite a long story that I wouldn't have guessed the ending to at the beginning, because I just sort of sent the manuscript out kind of randomly to agents. And it was actually my first child was like 2 weeks late. And so I thought she was going to be born, and then she just sort of stayed in. So I had these 2 weeks. I had managed to finish a draft of it before her due date, and then she just wasn't born. So I had time to sort of scramble, and I sent it out to a bunch of agents and got interest from one person. And And I thought, wow, this is really happening. And then it actually totally didn't. And then there was like a long process of sort of finding another person to work with and doing a lot of revisions. I ended up working with, I think, at least four different literary agents on this, and ultimately ended up with Marcus Hoffman of Regal Hoffman, who I think is terrific. And then, you know, when he submitted it, Bloomsbury was the first people to respond to it. So the finding a publisher actually happened like relatively easily and quickly compared to the process of finding a literary agency. So yeah, it did take a long time, but I think that's pretty normal. And I certainly would have. I mean, if I'd known it was going to take like. Well, gosh, if I finished the first draft when my daughter was born and she's 5 and a half now, if I'd known it was going to take that long, oh, I mean, I guess I would have done the same thing. What choice did I have? But yeah.
Well, we are so glad that did finally get published, because it's just a terrific novel, a terrific read. Adelia Saunders, your debut novel is Indelible. Thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Adelia Saunders has a master's degree in international relations from Georgetown University and has taught English in Paris, written for an independent newswire at the United Nations, and even assisted an agricultural economist in Uganda. She grew up in Colorado and lives with her husband and two children in New York City. Indelible is her first novel. And finally, here's a poem brought to my inbox by Poetry.org's Poem of the Day. This one is titled Art and is read by the poet Erica Jo Brown.
This is Art by Erica Jo Brown. Not many passions take your pants off. Painting with oils, reading in the afternoon, other people's bodies. I want to really say something here. I want to be clear. But just as no two people see the same colors, what you hear is not what I'm saying. Not conversations as much as serial misunderstandings, proximate in space. One considers the dictionary definition of man. One considers the definition of woman. One considers arm hair, soft spaces on a hot body. The obsessive, heat-seeking quality of attraction. The paint on my pinky is for you. A little poison, a little turpentine. The snaggle tooth I want to stick my tongue into. This is pigment from a rock. This is pigment from a bug. This is pigment from a bleeding heart. And this is Jeopardy. Passion brought me here, but passion cannot save me. To mix linseed and varnish, to create something is to vanish what was there before. Chroma for fastness, chemistry tricks. Such bold strokes in erasing and framing delicate beginnings.
That was Erica Jo Brown reading her poem, Art. You can sign up for the Poem of the Day from Poetry.org. Find the link at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.